Today's reading is Numbers 27, verses 1 to 11, and 36, verses 1 to 13. Then drew near the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, from the clans of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. The names of his daughters were Mala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest and before the chiefs and all the congregation at the entrance of the tent of meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness. He was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but died for his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be taken away from his clan because he had no son? Give to us a possession among our father's brothers." Moses brought their case before the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "The daughters of Zelophehad are right. You shall give them possession of an inheritance among their father's brothers and transfer the inheritance of their father to them. And you shall speak to the people of Israel, saying, 'If a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. And if he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. And if he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the nearest kinsman of his clan, and he shall possess it. And it shall be for the people of Israel a statute and rule, as the Lord commanded Moses.'" The heads of the fathers' houses of the clan of the people of Gilead, the son of Machir, son of Manasseh, from the clans of the people of Joseph, came near and spoke before Moses and before the chiefs, the heads of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel. They said, "The Lord commanded my Lord to give the land for inheritance by lot to the people of Israel. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. But if they are married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the people of Israel, then their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of our fathers and added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. So it will be taken away from the lot of our inheritance. And when the jubilee of the people of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry, and their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers." And Moses commanded the people of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying, "The tribe of the people of Joseph is right. This is what the Lord commands concerning the daughters of Zelophehad. Let them marry whom they think best. Only they shall marry within the clan of the tribe of their father. The inheritance of the people of Israel shall not be transferred from one tribe to another. For every one of the people of Israel shall hold on to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter who possesses an inheritance in any tribe of the people of Israel shall be wife to one of the clan of the tribe of her father, so that every one of the people of Israel may possess the inheritance of his fathers. So no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another, for each of the tribes of the people of Israel shall hold on to its own inheritance." The daughters of Zelophehad did as the Lord commanded Moses. From Mala, Tirzah, Hogla, Milcah, and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad were married to sons of their father's brothers. They were married into the clans of the people of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in the tribe of their father's clan. These are the commandments and the rules that the Lord commanded through Moses to the people of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. This is the word of the Lord.
So last summer, Hannah Rosen wrote an article in The Atlantic called The End of Men. This was a July-August issue. And it was a very, it was an interesting article, a very revealing article in what it documented. because Rosen was showing that actually things are really changing, and there are large gender trends that are underway. And she was talking about how women are coming to occupy a new and independent place in society. A lot of good things that she was talking about, but one of the things that she started out talking about how women could and men and couples could choose the sex of their babies now. You could choose, if you want to, the gender of your baby. You can choose as by filtering the sperm. And that just kind of anecdotal evidence from the clinics was that women were choosing girls and couples were choosing girls more than boys for their babies. And she starts from here and then talks about, documents all these changes in the education, in the whole educational system in schools and then in the workforce, showing what's going on. And she documents this very well. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, women now hold 51.4% of managerial and professional jobs. And that's up from 26.1% in 1980. They also make up 54% of all accountants, hold about half of all banking and insurance jobs. One-third of America's physicians are women, and 45% of associates in law firms are women now. And if that seems too low for you, it's one-third or 40%, don't worry, the percentages are rising fast. So it will soon be closer to 50%. We've heard of the collegiate gender gap, you know. Women now earn 42% of all MBAs, 50% of all law degrees and medical degrees, 60% of all master's degrees, and probably maybe the most important one is women earn now almost 60% of all bachelor degrees. So that's graduating from college upward about 60%. So the world is changing in this, that Hannah Rosen points out, and shows that, you know, one of the things it definitely shows is that women, given opportunity in these different scenarios and these different jobs they haven't been in, they can do the job just as well, sometimes better. So that's one thing that's going on. But Rosen expresses some concern in this about these advances should be some kind of feminist nirvana. But actually, she raises concerns. And interesting, she doesn't have to do this, but where she goes in the article, she links these gender trends to situations in relationships. And she actually kind of raises a question, is how good is this in terms of relationships between men and women? She ties this to the disintegration, or actually disappearance, in certain classes of people of marriage. And I thought this was really interesting, kind of how she went with this. Because, you know, when you look at the Bible and the Bible's teaching, a lot of people feel that it's got to be completely irrelevant to today. Because the Bible is written during these patriarchal times, and that's the way, just, you know, you read certain things about men and women in the Bible, and that's just the way they did things back then. So how could it be really hold wisdom for us or understanding today? But what I find is actually what Rosen highlights in her article is anticipated in the teaching of the Bible on gender. Actually, the Bible was saying these things first that are kind of illustrated in her article. So what I want to do today is actually look at that as we look at the role of gender in the covenant community that comes out in these two passages in the book of Numbers. So what we're reading here are two passages that begin and end the last section of the book of Numbers. This is really the end of, the second passage is the end of the book. The first passage just begins this second, after they have their second census. This is the third and last section of the book of Numbers when they're constituting their second army to take a promised land. So they're kind of bookends here. And the second passage, you notice, is kind of a coda to the first story. And they're meant to be taken together to tell us something. And what's at issue here and what's at stake for them is the promised land is preserving their tribal identities in that land. and stressing the importance of maintaining that those 12 tribe identities. Why is that important, friends? Why was it important to maintain their identities as 12 tribes? Because that's their story. By understanding themselves as these 12 tribes and preserving that identity, they can look back and understand their lives, that they are who they are because God was faithful in his promises to their forefathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. Jacob had these 12 sons that became these 12 tribes. So by holding on to that identity and making sure that identity is preserved in the land, they're holding on to the fact that they are only a people because of the promises of God in their lives. That's what makes them who they are. So these are passages really about their identity and understanding and preserving their identity. Interestingly enough, they're also passages about gender. Because these two passages, when we take them together, present two principles of gender that the Bible teaches throughout that are consistent themes throughout the Scriptures. And if you want to know anything about what the Bible teaches about gender, these two are it. You know, a lot of things to talk about and nuances, but if you want to say what is it foundationally the Bible teaches about gender, it's these two things, both of these principles. So let's look at them first in the first passage. The first passage teaches this quite clearly, that women are empowered as partners in this project of bringing the kingdom to earth. Of building and establishing the kingdom of God on earth, women are partners, and they're empowered as equal partners. It's all through this passage. We could just go verse by verse to look at it. Verse 1, first thing you see is that women have a voice in the covenant community. They come with their complaints. That's something very significant. They're allowed to come with their complaints. Verse 2 emphasizes how they can stand before Eleazar and Moses directly, speak with them directly themselves to talk about their concerns. And, you know, if you compare the two passages, if you put them side by side like we have done, you'll notice the direct correlation between chapter 27, verse 2, and chapter 36, verse 1. You'll see the scenes that directly compare, right? In the first one, the women come with a challenge to the current practice. In the second, the men come. Same procedure, same process, same privilege. You see what's being said here? Is that women and their gender occupy an equal partnership with the men in this project, in the community. Verse 3, my favorite, it shows that the women here, these daughters of Zelophehad, are theologically astute. They're with it. We can tell that by the reasoning that they use when they bring their case. They come and they say, look, our father, he died for his sin. He wasn't in the Korah's rebellion, though. You see what they're doing in their reasoning. They're showing that they had understood the way that God had taught the community to understand their lives. I can tell you there were certainly a lot of people wandering around out there in the desert with them who didn't get it. You can tell when there's conflict, they don't get it. These women do. They're understanding that, you know, the reason why we're wandering around the desert, the reason why this older generation is dying is because of their sin. There's this condition that we all have of our sinfulness. At the same time, they are showing by the reasoning they understand that there are degrees of heinousness of sin. So they're saying, you know, the father was not part of Korah's rebellion. So, you know, there's a distinguishing here of sins. And all of this is contained in the reasoning of verse 3, which tells us something, friends, that the women are part of the congregation in the wilderness's theological conversation. They're with it. Verse 4, they're faithful. Because these arrangements, these questions are being asked before the land had actually been won, you know, before it's even kind of formally distributed. Chapters in chapter 32. It kind of hadn't happened yet. So what they're doing is trusting in God's promises and even making this request. They're assuming it's going to be done because God said it was going to be done. Verse 5, they're challenging the accepted practice, and Moses' response to them is very telling. He takes them seriously. Seriously enough so that he even says, I got to get the Lord's answer on this. I got to depend on the revelation from God from this. I don't want to trust my own opinion. Don't want to trust my own judgment here. So you could go verse by verse and see the equality being preached here in the text. The equal partnership here. And it comes to a culmination in verse 7. There it is, where the women are empowered to own property. Second millennium BCE, these things are being commanded out there in the wilderness, out there in the desert. Daughters are usually received a dowry, but not an inheritance in the family estate. Moses is introducing a cultural change here, saying women should be allowed to own property. And, you know, this is rather significant. We kind of think, well, you know, maybe I own some real estate, that's something. But this is not just owning real estate. This is the land we're talking about. This is becoming caretakers, stewards of the land, which is the thing. It's the thing that makes the kingdom. This is the whole purposes of God, is to bring them to this land. They have this land, and the whole reason they can have a kingdom is because of the land. So it's a kind of a wrapping up of all different occupations and saying, these women can own the land. And so this is what I mean when I say that the Bible anticipates kind of the results that are documented in Rosen's article. Because just as she was saying, you know, given the opportunities, women can do fine in these occupations, the Bible is saying, God is saying here, yes, women are quite capable of the responsibility given the opportunity. There's not some kind of real difference here that we're talking about in abilities. That's what's being preached here. And if you think about it, it really is on God's mind to preach it. Because it could have been simpler, couldn't it? I mean, just it's simpler to pass it on to the nearest male relative, which is what the custom was. Right? Which is a usual practice. It goes to the father's brother if there are no sons. If not, then the nearest male relative, as they say here. But no, God wanted the women involved in preserving the inheritance. So he's trying to make a point with this less simple solution. The legal precedent he's establishing is proclaiming ontologically the equality of women, their involvement in the covenant community. Okay, that's the first principle. It goes back, it goes forward. From the very beginning, the women are equally in the image of God. They're just another flavor as men. Second principle, in the other half of the story, in Numbers 36. Verse 1, very similar scene, coming before Moses. Verse 3, they state the problem. The land, if this happens, when women marry outside of the clan, outside of the tribe, It's going to bring the land outside of the tribe. What will happen eventually? Because this is not just one case. This is a precedent for something that's going to be happening. There are going to be families where there aren't sons. So what will happen is the 12 tribe identity will be dissolving. Don't want that to happen. Again, in verse 5, God comes back and says the petitioners are right. Not only were the daughters of Zelophehad right, but here the sons of Gilead are right. We need a solution. Verse 6, the solution comes forth. A less simple solution, really. A constraint is placed on women who own property. And the constraint is that they have to marry within the tribe. The women respond to this by saying, yes, we will be faithful in that, and they marry their cousins on their father's side. All of this, verse 7 through verse 9, it keeps the land within the tribe. Okay, so similar situation. This time, the solution again is not as simple. Why not the easier solution? Easier solution is to say, you know, if you own property, you keep it, and you keep your own land, And if you move and to a different tribe, then a couple has to decide, you know, which land they want to have, because the land has to stay in the tribe. So the man who marries into Manasseh becomes part of the tribe, just as the women do, because the women were marrying outside of the tribe all the time and passing into that tribe. So why not, especially if God wants to establish this identity, it's very important to him, this equality, and the tribe is the greater purpose here, be simpler to say, just, you know, you marry the one with the land, and that land's the one you want, then she keeps it, you keep it. You switch tribes, take on her land. Instead, there's an asymmetry that's introduced that's affirmed here. A constraint is placed on the woman here, but not the man. And here's an opportunity where you could say, you know, let's really put women on equal standing as they are in the covenant community. Let's make sure that they're understood as equal partners in establishing the kingdom of God on earth. But instead, there's this constraint that's placed on the women. And you see what this does, actually, what this will do, this law. This law goes into effect, then within a few generations, the responsibility and stewardship of the land will pass back into the hands of the guys. Because they're going to have, that couple will have children, they don't have sons, the next one will. And the land will be bequeathed to the guys. And so eventually it's going to be guided, what these women are participating in is guiding the stewardship of the land, the responsibility of the property back to the men. And so there's something else that God is saying here, instead of going again for the simpler solution. There's something about the way that he wants gender to function among God's people's relationship here. Now, here's why I find, again, Rosen's article is anticipated, because she links gender trends to relationships and has expressed concern about the effects. How is this affecting relationships? And she's speaking this as a married woman, as a mother of three, and you know this because there's this video that was made of Rosen. It's an adorable video. I don't think it was made by The Atlantic. I think it was made by The Times, where they have a debate where on one side of the kitchen table you have Rosen and her daughter, and the other side of the kitchen table you have her husband and her son. And they enter into this classic, you know, battle of the sexes. Why girls are better than boys. Why boys are better than girls. You know, it's Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King all over again right there. And just like all battles of the sexes, it's classically ridiculous. You know, because as soon as you start talking about gender in those terms, about who's better, you lose it. You lose the thrust of the gift. You lose the import of the gift. But it's just adorable walking, you know, seeing them argue, and then the toddler comes out, and who's going to get the toddler? And it's an adorable video. But this second principle, the one that's difficult to talk about, is anticipated in the Bible. You have equality of persons, but you have these constraints on roles. Why? And I want to try to explain and talk about why. Before I do, let me just make a point about coming into the New Testament. Because it's sometimes suggested that, you know, you read the Old Testament, they had a certain view of women, but going to the New Testament represents a progress in understanding gender. You sometimes hear that idea. Friends, I don't see it. Because what we see actually in the New Testament is the same thing that we see in these passages. There's a fundamental equality, and at the same time, for some reason, there is this asymmetry that's introduced in terms of the relationships. Not in isolation, but in terms of the relationships. Now, last week, we looked at this, we saw it in the family relationships, in the household. What happens when we get to the New Testament? You have the leaders, the two main leaders, the main apostles, Peter and Paul. They both express the church as the household of God. Okay, this is the way they think about it. This is the way they talk about the household of God. Ephesians 2, 1 Timothy 3, 1 Peter 4. They talk about the church as the household of God. Why? Because the expectation is that relationships are going to be close relationships like you would have in a household. And in the close relationships, these things are going to go deeper. And so the New Testament brings these principles from the nuclear household into the household of God. And what does it teach? It teaches the same things. First, it teaches equality unequivocally. You have Jesus bringing women into his ministry, Jesus, women, prominent women, participating in the ministry of Jesus. You look at it in Luke 8, and it's pretty clear what's going on. Women prophesy in the New Testament church. They serve, they minister in the church. There are prominent women in the church. You can tell because they're named Phoebe, Priscilla, Yodia, Syntyche, right? You have these women. Fundamental equality is preached. At the same time, you have these passages that affirm, that teach an asymmetry in their relationships. In terms of the responsibilities of God's work, preserving the identity of God's people. So what happens? We have Jesus, who brings women into traveling with him, kind of unheard of for a traveling sage. Unprecedented. But when it comes time to choose his apostles, to become his authorized representatives, to become those who would be the foundation of the kingdom of God on earth, rebooted, he chooses 12 men. Had an opportunity to make a point there, since he was obviously committed to the equality of women, but then he introduces this asymmetry as well. 1 Corinthians 11, Paul is insistent that the church express its gender in worship when he talks about these head coverings. He says gender has to be expressed in your appropriate cultural context, and this principle originates in the creation gifts. 1 Corinthians 14, women are asked to be silent in the authoritative judging of prophecy. They were supposed to be prophesying along with the men, but asked to be silent in acting as the elders judging that prophecy. The elder qualifications that you see in the pastoral letters, 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1, expressed toward men. 1 Timothy 2, Paul is very clearly insistent on churches reserving a role of responsibility for the guys. It has something to do with the church relationships. So just as in the Old Testament, we see in the New Testament, it's affirming women's equality, but it issues these constraints to guide men and women in their relationships in the church. It doesn't talk about outside the church. It doesn't matter. But in the household of God, where these relationships are going to be deeper, it matters. Now, friends, you know, this is difficult. It's difficult to talk about, difficult to hear, I'm sure. And for this to do what it's supposed to do, there's got to be, there's got to be trust among the people involved. And that's why, one of the reasons why it's hard to talk about. Because often, you know, I recognize there are past occasions of misuse that have resulted in a lack of trust, as that especially are in the case of women. And I know some of your stories. I know these occasions. And you know what I want to say? I'm sorry. I am sorry as a man. I am sorry for all the ways that men have abused you. And some of them hiding behind these scriptures. Hiding these abuses behind these very scriptures. I'm very sorry as a man. As a man, I ask your forgiveness for our abuses. I know that doesn't solve all problems, but I think it's necessary to say. So, in light of this, why? Why then this consistent theme if it has such a potential for abuse? The answer, friends, is because of what these things do, what these asymmetries do in relationships when they're introduced. You know, the Bible doesn't speak of men as men, apart from speaking about women. It's also very hard to find a place where it talks about women apart from men. It doesn't speak of one without the other. Why? Because what the Bible is after is cultivating dependence on one another. The purpose of this law is so that they would stay dependent on one another. And so guess what this law did for them? It made them need each other. The men were required to steward the land for the women to make their homes in. The women were required to preserve the land along with the men, to guide them into the stewardship of it. It made them dependent on one another. Now, this is not the direction that many of us, that you hear many voices going to try to address abuses. You know, the feminist drive, the drive of many feminisms, in response to male oppression, has to be, what we need to do is establish women's independence. That's what's important to do. And it's logical. I mean, if somebody has hurt me, I need to work to make it so that I can't be hurt again. And if a class of people has hurt me, then I need to make it systematic so I won't be in a position of being vulnerable and being hurt. And so there's this drive for independence, but a lot of times that loses touch. A lot of times certain thrusts in feminism have lost touch with the experience of many women. Why Naomi Wolf, who, you know, one of our own Greenwich Villagers here, kind of built a reputation on that disconnect. She just wrote a book and said, you know, this is not the experience of many women. A lot of women like men. They're not angry at them. And when your feminism is angry at them, it kind of loses the experience of a lot of these women. But what God is saying, actually, the direction to go in to address this is not in the matter, and not in the direction of independence, but of dependence. It made them need each other in the stewardship of the land to realize God's promises. Now, this is anathema in our day of age. Just talk about dependence as something that might be better than independence, isn't it? I mean, you can't do that. Independence is next to godliness, right? So this is one of these virtues. I'm waiting for them to build a library, you know, or a city hall. When the top of those beautiful Corinthian columns, there are these figures, right? Various virtues. I'm waiting to see this library where, you know, at the top of the Corinthian columns, you have justice, right? Then you have scholarship, right? Next column, independence, right? I don't need anybody. Eat my Uzi, right? Independence. It's a virtue. It's considered a virtue. So this is difficult. What the Bible is trying to do and foster in close relationships is dependence. And the holiness that must come as you struggle through that dependence. And what does it mean? In the Bible, you see, gender is a gift for the other gender. And as soon as you assert what it is to be a man as something independent of relationship, as soon as you try to define the masculine in isolated terms, you lose it. As soon as you say, you know, I need my rights to be a man so I can be the man for myself, you lose what it's about. And, you know, as soon as you assert what it is to be a woman as something independent of relationship, as soon as you define the feminine in isolated terms, as soon as you say, I need my rights as a woman to be a woman for myself, you lose it. You lose the intent of the gift. Gender is a gift for the other gender. You know, that's why this sermon's longer. I'm sorry this sermon is twice as long. I just have to say everything twice. But I do, because you can't talk about one gender without the other. It's a gift for the other. Your masculinity is for the covenant women in your life. Your femininity is for the covenant men in your life. I'm not saying this, hear me, I'm not saying that there are not benefits to you as a woman being a woman. I'm not saying that there are not benefits to being a man as a man. I'm also not saying that there is not fellowship that you have with others of your own gender that's something very good and gives something to you. I'm not even saying this is a simple matter to figure out what this means. But this is the point. It is for the other. And do you know what God is trying to do? You really want to get into underlying the meaning of this law, what he was after with meaning of these New Testament injunctions? It's to bring us into the ultimate, the love of the universe. Because what do we read? At one point, Paul kind of is talking about gender, and he starts talking about the Trinity. He says, this is like the Trinity. This is like the persons of God. And what do we see in the persons of God? We see equality among the persons of God. And yet, even though there's equality among the persons of God, you see Christ voluntarily constraining himself to cultivate dependence in the Trinity. He constrained his glory, became a person. It was very inconvenient. But why did he do that? To enact the plan, to see the purposes of God come to fruition, and to cultivate this dependence within the Trinity itself. And so the Father made himself dependent on Christ to enact the plan to direct people into the Father's love. And Christ made himself dependent on the Father's running of things, on the Father to steward their identity. And so he'd say things like, you know, I don't say anything unless the Father tells me. I mean, friends, you think about that. I don't say anything unless the Father tells me. Honestly, don't you think Jesus Christ could have said something pretty good on his own? He's God, you know. And I think that he did, you know, I'm not saying I think, you know, it's just every single word. I think what he's saying is that the thrust of my teaching, the general direction and when to teach what, I rely upon the Father's direction to do that. Now, honestly, he could have done it as God. He voluntarily constrains himself, cultivates dependence and in that love. So he says, you know, I do what I see my Father doing. He says things like that. They could have done it differently, but they didn't. They could have done it in a way that didn't make them so vulnerable to each other. But they didn't. That's what we're being invited into. So how can I teach this? How can I teach this in the 21st century? How can I teach this in the Northeast? How can I teach this in the Village? And expect us to even, you know, take us seriously. Well, let me tell you something. The most wonderful thing about being a pastor is that nothing, nothing is theoretical. Nothing. You see, you get what you see. You see what you get in the people's lives. You say what you say something, it falls to the ground or it stands in the things that really matter, which is a woman's life or a man's life. You know, some people learning the Bible, wanting to teach, you know, learning the Word, they long to be in an academic environment where they can do research or they can teach, which is all very necessary and all very good, except you never get to see whatever it is you're teaching tried, tested, refined, lived out in a community of faithful believers where a vision of truth is forged or broken. But a pastor gets that. A pastor has to have that since the stakes are high in people's lives. So I want to thank you, Village Church, dear Village Church, for listening to me, for arguing with me, if necessary, but forging our understanding here that allows me to have the confidence to be able to come before you and say these things because I see your lives. I have a lot of women in my life, thankfully. I care very much about their development for God's purposes. I wouldn't teach this if I hadn't been able to become convinced that it's good. There was a woman in this church a little while ago, and she ended up in this relationship with this guy, and it was kind of suspect as to where the guy was spiritually. And it was... It was kind of a difficult situation. Do you know what happened? There were a group of guys who got together who approached her as their sister and say, hey, could you think about these things here? Could you think about what it is, what the gospel means here? And what we just want to know, you know, we care about you, what's happening in this relationship. A very kind of a dangerous thing to do. You know, it was courageous of them to do it. And do you know what that did to her? She was, as she told me afterwards, it did something inside of her. She was so grateful for the way that these guys actually approached her. And do you know what? She was very thankful for it, what it did in her life. And I got to tell you, when I heard that, I was very happy. You know what I said to myself? I said, it must be then that some of the relationships in this church have gotten deep enough for gender to come into play, for men to actually be taking some spiritual responsibility, using their gifts to build the other up. I've also seen men, and I've watched in context in our church, how women have encouraged and actually put men forward, encouraging guys to take responsibility of stewardship in the church. And I've seen what it's done to the men. It has advanced them. They have taken big steps in their lives because of it. And I saw, and I rejoice because these women are using their gifts to advance these guys. So how does it work out in our church? Let me just tell you what we do here to try to, and the reason we do it is for, because of these passages such as the ones in Numbers. The first thing is that we take that very much to heart and we see the importance of educating women on the theological conversation. That's why we look to find ways to bring them in on the theological conversation. So we don't separate women out from men as they do in, you know, very conservative synagogues or mosques. Because that would be absolutely opposed to the principle here in Numbers. We have to tend to women's faith as equally with the men, asking, are they being faithful in their decisions? The faithfulness of the women of a church is crucial to that church's survival. Their spiritual life matters there. Take their complaints very seriously, as in verse 5. Equally seriously. Because, you know, friends, in spite of what you hear, sexism is still very much alive and well today. There's a tendency for women to not have a voice, even today, even in places that are supposed to be no distinction churches. In spite of lip service that's being paid. I don't expect it to go away. Because people don't know how to handle gender. And our culture doesn't give us any kind of framework to do it. The cultural message is, you know, you just ignore gender unless you're in bed. And even then, feel guilty about being different. But not here. What we try to do, and what I've tried to do over the years here, individually, I've tried to take women to the next level of gifting. Because I firmly believe the church needs them operating. I know I need them. And so I've met, at least with the women who are on staff here, I've met in a very regular way, in a mentoring way, conditions in their lives permitting. For many years, more often, actually, than any men, apart from my sons, met with them. I and the other elders of this church have looked for ways to encourage women to lead ministries here, to be taking roles in leading ministries, using their gifts. Structurally, I've worked hard since I've gotten here to make sure the voice of women is heard in this church through strange entities called Zora horses, the Council of Dangerous Subversives. These Zora horses, these people, you know, coming together for sermon reviews, discussions about the church direction. For this Council of Dangerous Subversives, for those who are leading things in the church to come together and get equipped, we hope. For inviting women and groups of women to our session meeting. For having our prayers of adoration. You know, one of the reasons that we have a prayer of adoration every service is so that we can enjoy women praying as well as men. A couple of years ago, we decided we really needed to take a look at ourselves, become a little introspective as a church, and to take these things, take a look at ourselves, and try to see where we could improve as a church. So we formed something called a church health team, take us through a cycle of natural church development, necessarily co-ed. It was very important to me that it was co-ed. And that body has actually been very directive in the life of our church. Because, you know, all of this because I really believe that the voice of women in the community, without it, we can't apprehend the will of God. Women are partners in God's people in preserving the inheritance of Christ. Secondly, and every church needs to draw its lines in a way to try to enact both of these truths. For the sake of the relationships of the church, women are asked to refrain from eldership. What does this do, friends, when this happens? It does what the daughters of Zelophehad were willing to do, which is guide the responsibility back to the guys. And guess what many guys need? They often need to be prodded to taking spiritual responsibility. They often need to be nudged. They often need to be punched into taking a spiritual responsibility. I mean, have you seen any comedies recently? Just go see comedies. Any of these comedies, Knocked Up, you know, Going the Distance, or whatever. I mean, whatever is in the theater now, just whatever it is. What do you see there? And the idea of the genre, the director is trying to give you recognizable characters that are put in funny situations. Well, look at those characters. Do you recognize them? Look at the men characters in these comedies that you see. They're adults a lot of times. They're responsibility averse. They haven't grown up. Is that characterizing guys, maybe expressing something that guys need? Just look at this year's Super Bowl commercials, you know, if you didn't see them. Go back. Just go back and look. Look at the characters in them. So the women in this church adopt the constraints that we do for the guys. The men then are asked to take this responsibility for the women of stewardship, spiritual responsibility. And through this constraint, become dependent upon each other. Be guided into responsibility, just as the daughters of Zelophehad guided the responsibility of the land into the hands of their sons. And then the women, from a position of equality, make themselves voluntarily dependent. Ask the men to preserve the territory of the gospel for them to make their lives in. And what do growing women tend to need? What do they tend to need? They tend to need to learn to rest in faith. Tend to need to surrender being in control, needing to be in control. Might be perfectly capable of being in control, but something about needing to be there. Needing to rest and trust. We ask for men's attentiveness to them to do that. Now, finally, friends, I just want to say, if you're listening to this and it makes you fearful to hear, or even if it doesn't make you fearful, it makes you overwhelmed, and you don't even want to talk about it, you don't even think about it right now, that's okay. That's all right, in fact. Just put it there in the back of your mind. Forget it. Go on with life. If you do want to talk about it with me, please do, because I welcome discussion about it. I know, you know, people might be in different places with this, but a number of women here have told me that they found this teaching invigorating, or as one of you said, refreshing. And if you do, if you're in that place, please let me know to talk to me. If you can see this vision, then we're not done here. We need to further this conversation about how to further our church, because I need you. I'm that And that's not just a nice thing to say. I need you to teach me about the proper use of women's gifts, to help women in this way of their gifting, how this plays out in community life. Same is true of the men. So let's see how to become dependent and so enter into the very love of God. Amen. Amen. Will you stand with me, please?